Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you, and welcome to tonight's meeting of InForum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s. With a mission to inspire debate around political and cultural issues. I'm Kathleen Fletcher, Director of the Institute for Nonprofit Organization Management at the University of San Francisco, and I'm here with Aaron Hurst, founder of the Taproot Foundation. Tonight, Aaron Hurst is recipient of InForum's 21st Century Visionary Award, honoring young people who are shaping our future. Hurst founded the Taproot Foundation to break down the barriers between the nonprofit and corporate sectors in the United States. Inspired by the work of Hurst's grandfather, Joseph E. Slater, author of the original blueprint for the Peace Corps, Taproot is allowing business professionals to volunteer their skills in the nonprofit sector, thus strengthening the community. Because of Aaron, Taproot is reshaping the relationship between these two sectors and redefining volunteerism as we know it today. Please join me in welcoming Aaron Hurst. So I'm going to be asking Aaron questions about the Taproot Foundation, but also about a lot of other things about young people and the nonprofit sector and his experiences that help him to give us a lot of insight into that. So first we'll just ask Aaron to describe how the Taproot Foundation works.
Sure. Make sure this microphone's in the right place. The Taproot Foundation, I think many of you know, is involved basically in trying to help nonprofits build their capacity to do what they do better. And the fundamental model that we use is we take business professionals out of companies and put them into teams doing consulting engagements for nonprofits. Each of these engagements lasts about 5 months and enables a team to really make a significant impact on a nonprofit. So that's sort of the high level sort of how it works. I'm happy to dive into any other pieces of it if you or any of the audience wants to sort of drill down.
Well, how did you get the idea for the foundation, and why did you think it would work?
Well, it's funny, because you mentioned my grandfather and the blueprint for the Peace Corps. And actually, my grandmother, who's here, gave me a wonderful lecture over brunch on Sunday about the reality of exactly how my grandfather's work transpired working in D.C. about 40 years ago, and really inspiring the idea and the power of people going into another culture and how powerful that is as a means of really inspiring you and building understanding about society and different societies. And early in my career, I became really frustrated by the separation between the for-profit and nonprofit sector. And really wanted to look at how could you take that concept of the Peace Corps, that idea that getting people to do meaningful work in a deep way over a period of time, how could you take that core idea and use it as a means of breaking down the barriers between the for-profit and nonprofit sector? And had that idea sort of as early as college, where I saw the difference between the business school and the fact that they offered free sodas versus the public administration building where the toilets didn't even work, and felt like there's got to be a better way to sort of understand and appreciate the differences and to break down these silos. And I think, you know, to your question, how did I know it was going to work? I had no idea that it was going to work. It was one of many things that I was sort of playing with to see if it would work. And intuitively, it made sense to me that there's a lot of business services that are offered that business people could do in their sleep, from websites, brochures, basic HR functions. These things are done so routinely. And when I talked to nonprofits about what they needed, it was that same list of things. And it was sort of that aha moment when the peanut butter and chocolate merged together and you had the Reese's peanut butter cup. Sort of this idea of, you know, you could put these things together and actually solve this capacity building challenge, or at least make a major dent in it.
Yeah, good. Well, how do you actually recruit the volunteers from within the companies?
Sure. One of the most common misperceptions about Taproot is that we get all of our volunteers through companies. So that is one way that we do it. So, for example, we have partnerships with Wells Fargo, Microsoft, Time Warner, where we actually go in and build a consulting firm at their company. So at Time Warner, We have a pro bono consulting firm at Time Warner that draws people from CNN, HBO, Time Inc., et cetera, to do consulting engagements. And it's much like a headhunting firm where we actually go in and partner with all the executives. So when we're staffing a project, we tap, you know, the head of HR on the shoulder and say, who do you got that can do this? And we go in and actually get them on projects. That's probably where 10% of our volunteers come from. The 90% comes from a mixture of word of mouth, which is a wonderful thing, and partnerships with job boards. So, for example, Dice.com, the biggest IT job board in the country, just donated $200,000 in free job board advertising to Taproot. So now when you're looking for a job in engineering anywhere in the U.S. Where we have an office, it's like job, job, job. Have you thought about doing pro bono? And that has been the most powerful way, because a lot of people aren't looking to do pro bono work because they don't know that's an option to them.
Yeah.
So we really have to get them when they're thinking about something else and are looking for change in their lives. And that's been sort of a very consistent, strong source of volunteers.
Very interesting. Well, how does a nonprofit organization get to be the lucky one that gets the help?
We have this huge wheel in the office that we spin, and it just picks random nonprofits in the area.
Right.
The way that we actually, it's been a really interesting process to look at best practices of foundations, which is what we've modeled ourselves after, to figure out how do you really identify the nonprofits that need help and get them the right resources. And I had a great mentor in Dick Matkin from the Peninsula Community Foundation that really taught me a lot about respectful and thoughtful grant making. And we really try to model it after a lot of his wisdom. And it's really a combination. We do outreach to the nonprofit sector, and they apply to us for these projects. But it's really a combination of talking to them about the impact they're having in the community, as well as, I think more importantly, are they going to be a good client, which has to do with, is it the right project? Do they have a clear decision-making structure in place? Do they have any unrealistic expectations for the project? So early on when we were starting, there are a lot of nonprofits that would come in and say they needed a website, and they'd say why. And they had this expectation that if they put a website up, someone would just come and donate $1 million online they'd never talk to. So just sort of trying to make sure that their expectations are aligned with what we could actually deliver.
Yes. what do you see as some of the positive outcomes? I mean, obviously, between the, in the match between the the volunteers and the nonprofit, obviously one positive income is they get, or one positive outcome is that they get what they need, but other things.
We had a couple of volunteers get married, and that was a wonderful outcome.
Great.
No, we've had a number of, I think, sort of unexpected outcomes. We actually do surveys of all the nonprofits after we do a project. And one of the things that I found really wonderful is how many have stated that just the process itself of doing one of these projects strengthened their governance and management infrastructure. So just going through a rigorous consulting engagement and having to really align their management team and their board to make key decisions to affect their positioning or to affect their core HR strategy really forced them to address a lot of issues and to think about how to make decisions. And that's been a really wonderful outcome. Another is that many of our volunteers serendipitously end up on the boards of the nonprofits. And having my own board and worked with a lot of different boards, these volunteers make phenomenal board members because they actually understand the importance of capacity building. So they're not going on with a lot of naive concepts about nonprofits, but they've actually gone through and really have a deeper understanding for what it actually takes to run a nonprofit. And we've just heard some really positive feedback from nonprofits about their impact.
Great. What have you learned about providing this kind of service? I'm sure everything hasn't always gone smoothly. And have you had to make changes along the way in any of your structure or models?
I think the core piece of it has always remained the same, the idea of sort of a structured engagement in which there's a set project plan, a set process. I think there's been a lot of refinement to it. I mean, we've on a daily basis are refining our processes to be able to do a better and better job of meeting both the volunteer and nonprofits needs. Some of the, I mean, it's James Shepherd, who's here, once described part of what we're trying to do is, you know, similar to trying to sell airplane tickets for a major airline, and that you've got all these people trying to buy tickets for an airplane, and you got to have just the right number of planes to be able to, with first class tickets, business class, coach class. We have the same sort of challenge in staffing all of our projects, and that we always have to have just the right mix of people so that all the planes can take off and make sure that all the nonprofits get the resources they need. So a lot of our improvements and a lot of our sort of challenges have been around perfecting that model so that we can effectively get people on a plane immediately so they don't have to sit around wait at the airport.
Great. So. Okay. Well, you are growing, I know that. And what are your plans for the future? How do you see Taproot growing? Where are you now? Where do you want to be in various cities, et cetera?
Sure. So we're in 5 cities now. We're in the Bay Area, Seattle, Chicago, New York, and Boston. And we'll be adding probably another 5 cities in the next 3 to 5 years. And that's really important because there's so many nonprofits in these other cities that we want to reach. The more important piece for me was a realization a couple years ago, just that, you know, we're already the largest nonprofit consulting firm in the country, but we're still just touching such a small percentage of nonprofits, and realizing that even when we scale our program to be able to do all kinds of different services and do thousands of projects a year, we're still just going to be scratching the surface. Mm-hmm. So really moving to invest a lot in thought leadership. So we've actually partnered with the White House this year and are doing a major event in February where we've got the White House to agree to challenge the business community as a whole to increase pro bono by $1 billion a year. Okay. And looking at what it's going to take across academic circles, across trade associations, companies, consulting firms, to achieve that kind of a goal, to really bring a huge sea of resources into the sector. So that's really the launch of a whole initiative we're doing around thought leadership to really understand what it's going to take to make the business community adopt a pro bono ethic the way the legal profession has, and to manage that resource so that any nonprofit that has a core need has that need met.
Mm-hmm. That sounds wonderful.
Hopefully. We've got Tony Dungy, the head coach of the Indianapolis Colts, keynoting. So it should be a very interesting mix of conversation.
Okay. And how did you get in with the White House?
A wonderful board member who works in Washington. And I think that there's the Bushes, both senior and junior, have invested a lot in volunteerism. I think it's one of the core parts of their legacy. And actually, the story is that when George Bush Sr. left the White House, sort of the one thing he said to Clinton as he was leaving was, whatever you do, don't cut my volunteer programs. And that was something that Clinton honored and that his, you know, now George W. Bush has really invested a lot in. So there's a real legacy there. But I think there's been a challenge in the country. Everybody wants more volunteerism, but it's not a quantity game. It's really a quality game. And I think that when we explain sort of how we could bring quality to volunteerism, it really resonated with that legacy.
Makes sense. One more question on Taproot. How do you evaluate? You've already mentioned that you send surveys to the nonprofits. How else do you evaluate the success of what you're doing?
Sure. I mean, we look at volunteers and whether or not they come back. We ask 100 hours of every volunteer. And we have at this point close to 50% of them that immediately come back and do another 100 hours with us. So that to me is a major measure. You know, if you go into business, repeat business is one of the best measures. So that's a great one. Same thing on the nonprofit end. The other piece we're starting to do is actually 6 months to a year after a project's done, we go back and say, did it actually have the impact on the nonprofit that they had hoped for? There's often that sort of the glow right after a project that a nonprofit has just from having completed the project, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it made a damn bit of difference to the organization. So really trying to look and see whether or not there actually has been a change in the organization.
Very good. Okay. Well, what about, I mean, you're obviously a very strong social entrepreneur, as the word is used now. how do you think, and many people in your generation are much more, I think, of the social entrepreneur type. And I'd like to think a little bit about how you see your generation and the younger generation in contrast to my generation, the boomer generation. And how are you guys changing the worlds of volunteerism and philanthropy?
It's hard. It's such a broad question in terms of looking at the generations. It's something we've really struggled with. I think in a lot of ways, there's a difference fundamentally in the approach. I think that the boomer generation is a very activist generation. There's often this sort of fight the power mentality in a sense of sort of pushing back against a system. And what I see in my generation and millennials and whatever my daughter is, who's now 2, is she's actually not showing any traits yet, but I'm hoping, is much more of a pragmatic approach, which I talk about more being the power instead of fighting the power, and realizing that there's an accessibility to being in that seat of power and using that for good. I think a lot of the CSR movement, a lot of what you're seeing in the media today, the whole Google sort of theme is a lot about that sort of sense of, you know, we can change this. And I remember there was one, I was talking to a woman who was a boomer about a problem. I forget what it was. It had something to do with violence in her neighborhood, and her immediate response is, we need to get a bunch of people together and picket you know, the State House. And I was like, what good is that going to do? I mean, you'll get a little bit of press about it. Like, this is a pretty obvious issue. Makes sense. Like, why don't you just go get legislation written and do it? And that's like a fundamental difference, mm-hmm. I think, between the generations. I think the other one is that there's, and this is sort of my bias, and maybe it's just rebellion against my parents who are boomers, but I think Generation X and Y are getting a lot of wonderful legacies from boomers, but we're also getting an awful lot of problems. I mean, the environment, healthcare, I mean, all these issues have really been exacerbated by the boomer generation, and boomers are still in the midst of their power, so they're still in a position, I think, to really reverse that. And there's that great ad they have down at the BART stations basically saying, what are you leaving to your children? And it shows two little kids in a desert. And I think boomers still have an opportunity to reverse the course of a lot of what they've done, but I think our generation's realizing that it's probably going to be up to us to actually fix a lot of these problems that have been left to us. So there's the sense of, like, we better be pragmatic about it because we don't have a lot of time to sit around fighting about how to solve these problems. Because as each generation passes, it's going to get exacerbated, and we've got to do something now.
What kinds of motivations, you've talked some about that, but what do you see as primary motivations for volunteerism and for giving in your generation? Anything beyond what you've said?
I don't know that it's any different. I mean, I think a lot of people want to have meaning. I think there's more of it. I mean, the boomer generation is notoriously bad at their level of donations and level of civic engagement. I mean, it's the worst it's been in a long time, and we're seeing that pick up again with Generation X. I think part of it's a sense of hope and a sense of being able to actually get involved and do something. I think there's also just, I think, a sense that the contributions of an individual can be greater, and therefore people feel inspired to do something.
Okay. How do you see the role of technology in all of this with your generation and the and volunteerism and giving in particular? There's such a fundraising is so different now based because there's so much internet fundraising, et cetera. Just any thoughts that you have on that?
I don't think it's that big of a difference in general on the fundraising side. I mean, there are pieces that are definitely changing, but it's still definitely a very small part of the overall equation. On the volunteerism front, I think it's radically different. I mean, you look at a volunteer match, which is now connecting millions of people that wouldn't have otherwise been connected, and there it's tremendously powerful. Because I think people will volunteer somewhat blindly that way, whereas if you had a donor match, people just wouldn't fundamentally give that way. So I think it's much more profound on the volunteerism end. The other piece to me, which is tangential, is just globalization and how that connects to technology, and that people are much more concerned about what's happening outside of their town, state, country, and then the world. Whereas I think historically there's been much more of a sense of taking care of what's close to you. And now that people have access to such a wide set of media and are able to access things via the internet, there's an interest in making a difference abroad more than there was in the past.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that I've noticed, we have at USF, we have a master's degree in nonprofit administration. And many of the students are, they're already working in the nonprofit sector, but they are in their 20s and 30s. And one thing that I've noticed after having taught in the program for over 20 years, a lot more people saying they want to start their own nonprofit organization.
Yep.
I wondered if you would comment on that. I mean, I do see that as a generational change. I don't think as many people, well, certainly a lot of programs were started by boomers, but I never remember 10 years ago that many people in class saying, I want to start my own nonprofit.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's been so many nonprofits started, and there were so many social entrepreneurs, I think, in the 70s and the 80s. I mean, I think there was an awful lot of that. Didn't have had a different name, and it wasn't glorified the way it is now. I think social entrepreneurs are becoming sort of mini movie stars in some way, and there's like a glorified sense of that starting your own thing. So I think that's part of it. The other piece is that I think a lot of Gen X folks are not feeling compelled to join the existing nonprofits that are out there. They're not finding the leadership and vision that they want to see. They're not seeing the level of ambition in the organizations and therefore feel like they need to create something of their own. So I see a lot of that when I do informational interviews. People say, I've gone out and talked to all these different nonprofits and just fundamentally I don't feel like I'm going to be able to fulfill my personal vision at those nonprofits because they're not ambitious enough and they're not taking a hard enough look at what the issues are. That was certainly my experience.
Yeah, that makes some sense. I'm just thinking that they maybe they've tried a lot and don't feel like they've succeeded as much, and they just don't have the optimism that someone's starting out and wanting to found their own nonprofit.
I was talking to Brooke Mahoney out of New York, who runs a great organization.
I know her.
Board. Yes, I'm sure you do. Makes sense. But she was talking about how she had a similar idea to Taproot maybe 15 years ago, and had come to the conclusion that it wasn't possible. And it was largely because technology was at a different place then than it is today. Mm-hmm. But she basically had said it's not possible and sort of put that aside as no longer being something even on the radar. And I think that's part of it, is just there's a whole new set of technology, a new set of thinking. There's a new world. And I think a lot of people who had started organizations a long time ago had given up on things that now don't need to be given up on anymore.
If nonprofits are trying to appeal to people of your generation for either money or for volunteers, what do they need to do and what do they need not to do? How could they get in trouble?
Fundamentally, I think it's the same for any generation. You just got to make sure people feel like you're valuing them. Mm-hmm. And I think that has to do with valuing their skills, their time, their money. And I think when that doesn't happen, you're not going to get people who really are engaged. I don't think it's fundamentally that different. I mean, people are people and they want to be valued. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the stuff's really in the margin.
Mm-hmm. How do we appeal to nonprofits? How do nonprofits appeal for donations of not volunteer work, but of money?
It's interesting. I don't feel like statistically, I see a lot of philanthropy happening with Gen X in terms of relative to population. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a lot of it in my peers and a lot of the people that we interact with. They're very focused in, since they can't give a lot of money at their age, they're more focused in on how can I be a major donor by being on a board or giving mm-hmm. my skills, where the value of my time is such that I make a meaningful impact. Mm-hmm. I think part of the challenge is that people don't feel great about making the $50, $100 donations because they don't feel like they're making a big enough impact. And they just feel like it goes into a sea of money. And they want to figure out a way to concentrate sort of what they can give. So like our volunteers probably make $100,000 a year, $75,000 a year. And they could make decent donations, obviously, with that. Mm-hmm. But if they can give $10,000 a year of their services, they suddenly feel like they're a major philanthropist. Mm. And that's much more compelling than writing a bunch of $100 checks.
Yeah, that's good. Good answer. I like that. You were talking about CSR, or corporate social responsibility.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that and how you see that coming, fitting in with Taproot, and also just what we see in that area. It certainly is. I don't know how long the term's been around, but it hasn't been a terribly long time.
Yeah, it's been about 15 years.
Yeah.
It's still very much in its infancy. My wife actually works in the field, so I get a lot of pillow talk on the topic. But the thing that I've found is that there's a lot of companies that are still in a very sort of nascent stage with CSR, where they're still thinking about it purely as, you know, donations and just generally rounding up all their employees for a day of caring. And this really is an unsophisticated and not terribly effective model. And when you actually talk to most nonprofits, it's an incredibly unhealthy relationship, because the nonprofits end up doing a lot of work mm-hmm. for the money. And for a very little amount of money, they work, do a ton of work. They probably spend $10,000 of staff time to do a bunch of volunteer activity in which they get a $5,000 check from the company for doing it. And the company feels like their employees have made this huge impact, when in reality, they basically have been given errands to chase around doing stuff to be able to get access to that corporate money. So it's a very unhealthy cycle. So I think some companies are starting to break out of that in a couple ways. One is they're seeing CSR as a hell of a lot more than just philanthropy and volunteerism. And it has a lot to do with a comment actually that I heard one of our volunteers, I think it was one of our volunteers say, which is, you know, I can go out and plant a tree as my volunteer effort, but if my company at the same time is cutting down 10,000 trees a day, it's kind of disingenuous to say that I'm actually making a difference. So I think companies are starting to realize that as a whole, and starting to look, instead of setting up those Plant a Tree Days, to look at how they don't cut down 10,000 trees a day. And I think those are the programs that are really powerful. And then on the philanthropy and volunteerism side, saying, what do nonprofits want? And starting with that instead of what do we want to do from a PR perspective. Mm-hmm. And when they ask the question, the United Way of the Bay Area did a great survey on this. When they ask the question, what do the nonprofits want? They want the skills of business professionals. They don't want just a bunch of bodies. They actually want work to get done. And they just don't see that happening enough. Mm-hmm. So as companies start to realize that, I think we'll see a real shift in how they think about community engagement. And I think it'll be a real breakthrough.
So it's more using their skills that come from the business, as opposed to just their time in doing something. I mean, some companies, for instance, will give their volunteers or their business employees a couple hours a week to tutor someone or something like that. You're seeing it more like actually giving the skills that they have at business away.
And it's fundamentally a respect issue. So, you know, if you're McKesson or The Gap or another company, you would never ask your CEO to go and paint the walls of your office. Like, that would just be considered an incredible waste of their time. But why is that suddenly an acceptable thing to ask them to do for a nonprofit? Mm-hmm. And that's what companies often do. They just want these events. And what is that fundamentally saying about the company's sense of value of that nonprofit? That they fundamentally think it's like an effective place to have their CEO go and paint a wall. And I think nonprofits really want people to come there as whole and to be able to bring what their greatest assets are, which is their skill and passion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I'm finding I agree with a lot of things you're saying. One thing that occurred to me is that you are a founder, and you've probably heard of founder syndrome.
Yep.
And it sounds like you have avoided it by moving on and continuing to help the company grow, et cetera, rather than staying behind and, in a way, holding it back. Do you want to comment on what you... what you've been able to do as a founder?
I think it's day to day, whether or not I'm having that founder syndrome impact on the organization. I think I've tried to really separate out and bring in really senior experienced managers to manage the programs once they've been relatively well defined so that they can really have an ongoing operation that I don't meddle with and that really is focused on delivering what we've already developed and focusing more of my time on evangelism and on developing sort of the next wave of things. Mm-hmm. There's always a tension there, but I think it's a healthy tension. Mm-hmm. There will come a time, I'm sure, when having me involved at that level is sort of, you know, does more harm than good. And I think for me, every year as I do my annual planning process, I ask that question of, am I at that stage? And I've got about, I think, at this point, five other nonprofits that I've been sort of thinking about wanting to start. So when the time comes that I feel like I'm no longer able to provide more value than sort of harm I cause, go on to my next sandbox.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. What about another topic, the leadership challenge that we've been hearing about? Those of us in the nonprofit sector, anyway, have been hearing that there's a leadership crisis, the boomers, when they retire or are staying in too long, and so the next generation is not able to move forward, and people are not getting the training they need, et cetera, et cetera. Have you seen that in the groups you've been working with? What's your sort of take on the, is there a leadership challenge, and how can we overcome it?
No, I mean, the research has all said that there is a leadership challenge. I think the bigger issue is just retention of people in the sector. Mm-hmm. There's been such a proliferation in the number of nonprofits, and there needs to be a consolidation, but there also has to be an environment where high-performing people want to stay. And I think until there's an environment where people want to stay, you're not going to retain that next set of leadership. I had so many friends that right out of college, including myself, went into nonprofits and left within a year because they fundamentally didn't feel well leveraged. And as long as you have that problem, you're not going to develop that next generation of leaders. I think the second piece is, as we talked about earlier, we do need a new generation of talent. I think we need people who can go in there and say, yeah, we've made those assumptions, but those assumptions are no longer relevant, and really move things to the next level. So I think a lot of times there's sort of this crying wolf around all the boomers retiring, but it's actually a tremendous opportunity for a new set of leaders to emerge and let the boomers be on boards, let them play a role in mentoring, but really recognize that there's a chance to really break through and redefine what the sector is. Because the sector is pretty, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's really not that old sort of a concept. Mm-hmm. And there's a chance to really redefine it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about, how can those younger leaders gain the skills, and you said that they're not getting it. What's the solution to that? Any solution to the leadership challenge?
No, I think there's two different things. I mean, one is for people to go into the for-profit side first and get the skills they need. The challenge there is that the money is often so seductive that they never leave. Mm-hmm. I think the other one is to really get the HR profession and the business world to donate their skills to help build the infrastructure of nonprofits so that nonprofits have the infrastructure to really understand how to develop people, how to mentor them, et cetera. And there's so many HR people. And HR is one of the most compassionate fields out there. I mean, in the business of helping and nurturing people. But they just are so seldom asked to go in to help a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And it's such an opportunity to really go in there. And when I talk to executive directors, the number one like most valuable resource that I hear them get is when they get to talk to a senior HR person and realize that there's ways to solve all those terrible personnel problems that they have. And that there's a way to actually make their employees feel engaged and really productive in their jobs. So I just think there's such an opportunity for the HR profession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about the difference between working in the nonprofit sector and the for-profit sector? You've been in both. You've seen them both. What do you find as some of the biggest differences?
Well, I think the thing that to me is the most important is a question of scale. And I think one of the most common misperceptions is that often people out of large companies sort of look at a nonprofit and they talk about how different it would be to work at that nonprofit. Fundamentally, most nonprofits are the equivalent of like a corner store or maybe a restaurant. And I would guess that the average sort of nonprofit of that size is actually probably better run than the average restaurant or corner store and has more infrastructure and more support than that average small business. So on an apples-to-apples basis that way, I don't think there is a whole lot of difference. When you look at like a Cisco and compare that to a tiny homeless shelter, there's a tremendous amount of difference. I mean, the biggest one to me is the resources available to do your job. And the second one is specialization. One of the great things about working at a small nonprofit is you get to monkey around with a lot of stuff. If you're working 20 layers deep at Cisco, you've got a very specific task and you're measured on what you do that day. So I think working at a small nonprofit is much more interesting job than working at most companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I've noticed over the years is that working in the nonprofit sector in a large organization like the American Cancer Society or the YMCA or something like that is really a lot like working in a large corporation, whereas working in a small nonprofit, I think, would you agree with that?
Yeah,
that
it's sort of the Fortune 500 of nonprofits are very similar to their counterparts.
Yeah.
And they have the same bureaucratic problems that companies have as well.
Okay. How about the measurement of success in the two sectors?
Yeah, as an organization, I think it's very different. I mean, obviously, companies are bottom-line driven, and nonprofits have a much more complicated set of measurements. So I think measuring success and managing success is so much more challenging in the nonprofit sector. I think when it comes down to an individual's job, though, it's very similar. And this is one of the things, one of the reasons I started Taproot was to try to get beyond the stereotypes between for-profit and nonprofit. And I have a former colleague here from my dot-com days. But what I found in the dot-com era, which is where most of my corporate experience came from, is people weren't motivated by money. They were motivated by who they worked with and being able to actually make a contribution. And that doesn't mean a contribution to society, but just the sense that they were part of a team that actually got something done and they could feel good about that. They were craftsmen and women who really loved what they did as a craft. And the dot-coms were wonderful because they had a lot of resources to do all kinds of projects. And I think that's fundamentally true for-profit or nonprofit. It's not a money motivation for most people. It's fundamentally about who you work with and being able to actually get something done and feel like at the end of the day you were productive.
How about in the sense that some people have that nonprofits need to run more like a business or be more businesslike?
And it goes back to the whole size issue. I think nonprofits don't need to run like Cisco and they don't need to run like a corner store. I don't think either one of those is a model that you'd want to use. I love Jim Collins's work on this topic. And he's did that huge study on the corporate size for looking at what truly determine high performance. And the one that really stands out is discipline. And I don't think that that's a nonprofit topic. It's not a for-profit topic. It's really a fundamental approach to management and being able to make difficult decisions and focus on what really matters. So I think there's very little to be learned in some sense and more a question of what is good management and what's bad management. And I think that neither sector has a monopoly on either one of those.
Yeah, I think that's true. What about what do you think the government should do, if anything, to either help nonprofits or work with this? We have changing government. Things are obviously we're going to have a new administration, whichever party gets in. Sure. If you were talking to candidates, what would you want them to do about the nonprofit sector at this point?
It's an hour topic at least. I think a lot of it is studying what nonprofits are doing. I think we could get rid of an awful lot of nonprofits with very simple legislative changes that wouldn't cost any money, where they're just fundamentally, or cost a minimal amount of money, and the ROI would just be so apparent. Foster care is one of these topics where people are aged out of the foster care system at 18, and they're fundamentally not set up to be adults yet. If we can just change that age to 21, it'll cost a little bit more, but you'd have a huge decrease in homelessness. You'd have a huge decrease in healthcare costs. Like, the ROI is just so obvious. Mm-hmm. So I think the number one thing I'd ask the government to do is put nonprofits out of business by looking at how they've had to basically work around bad legislation to make things possible. And that would just make a huge impact. The next piece is when they do fund nonprofits, we need to figure out a more entrepreneurial method for it. The amount of money that's spent at nonprofits in this country just to fill out paperwork for the nonprofit sector is so atrocious. I mean, it's just such a waste of money. And talk about boring jobs you want to leave. I mean, just you see some of these HUD reports. I mean, they're literally like this big. It's disgusting. So I think there's a huge opportunity there as well. And the final piece, which is more a fantasy on my end, I'd like to see pro bono work, where people actually donating their skills and their time, be something that people got a tax credit for. Because it's really about taking time in their profession and making a donation of that. I don't know if it's a dollar for dollar piece. There's a lot of issues around how you logistically do it. But I think there needs to be a valuing of people's time and not just their money.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Well, you mentioned that you would like to... you have already thought about three or four different organizations that you'd go, or things that you would do if you felt it was time to leave Taproot. Where are some of the places that you'd like to take your energy in the future?
Sure. I mean, one of it's this legislation question. I'd love to be able to create an organization that really could look at all the places where nonprofits have basically been created because of poor legislation, and look at identifying what legislation would have like a very obvious ROI or basically wouldn't have any cost associated with it, that could just fundamentally change, I think, a lot of the sector. And I think that that work I've never seen done well, and I think there's a real opportunity to pragmatically look at that. Mm-hmm. Similarly, I think the whole issue around nonprofit scaling, you know, as long as nonprofits stay corner stores, they're not going to get far beyond selling candy bars. Like, they need to figure out how to get bigger. I'd love to look at how you take successful nonprofits that are really needed and how do you incubate them into other cities? Something that I think has really not been done successfully to date. And then my other areas are much more politically affiliated, including the fact that I'm a vegetarian. And I think similar to sort of the environmental movement and how it went from being sort of fringe to now being much more mainstream and packaged effectively, I think vegetarianism has not been packaged effectively. Mm-hmm. I think of my father-in-law, who at our wedding, the thought of like not serving meat at our wedding, he felt like would insult his friends. And he had no idea how you could have a decent meal that didn't have meat involved in it. And, you know, now that I got to know him and took him out for a dinner that didn't have meat involved in it, he was shocked that you could actually be satiated without eating meat. And I think a lot of Americans are in that similar boat, which is that they just don't fundamentally know that you can have a good meal that doesn't have meat. So I have a lot of different ideas about how to sort of mainstream that idea, which I think would have a huge impact on animal rights, but also on the environment and on a lot of labor issues.
Mm-hmm.
So a wide range.
A wide range, yeah. if you have any favorite causes that outside of Taproot and the work that you've been doing, what really inspires you or that other people perhaps have done in starting organizations or in work that they do in the nonprofit sector or just for the betterment of either mankind or animal kind or whatever?
No, I mean, a lot of it's related to the work we do. So I'm on the Board of Public Architecture, and some of my colleagues are here from that organization, which really works to look at how the built environment affects social and environmental issues. And being a fan of architecture and also just knowing what an impact sort of the room that I'm sitting in has on my experience and sort of whether or not I'm happy or not at a most basic level, I think there's a real profound opportunity for us to not treat buildings and architecture as an afterthought, but actually move it to the front of the conversation. So that's a very inspiring topic to me. Another one's a great organization that's involved in getting MIT and other engineering school students, instead of working on theoretical projects, they actually go to, say, Africa and look at an actual problem. for example, drinking water in a small village. And they get the whole engineering school that year to focus their energy on trying to solve that problem. So at the end of the year, they've got their diploma, but they've also hopefully invented something that can save lives. Mm-hmm. And to me, again, it's called Design That Matters. And I think that's a perfect name for it. Mm-hmm. Because students are such a great resource, and yet we waste so much of their time doing nonsense projects with faux clients when, in fact, people are dying and we could actually make a difference.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. What about the whole issue of globalization and working in other countries? When you talked about inventing something that could be used in Africa or some other place. Obviously, we're in a new era of globalization. How is that changing things, and how do you see yourself being involved in that at all?
Yeah, we actually did a pilot project in Tokyo a couple years ago through a gentleman that just contacted me and said, I love what you're doing, and he created Service Grant Tokyo. And what he found was that it completely translated and worked in Tokyo. The challenge was funding, because philanthropy doesn't exist nearly the same way it does in the U.S. and really hit a wall there. But we've had requests from India, London, Amsterdam, a lot of different locations for what we're doing. I think there's a tremendous opportunity. I also think a taboo topic, which is outsourcing. I think the nonprofit sector has not really looked at how to use offshoring and outsourcing to address social needs. So, for example, you know, India has such a great wealth of educated people. You know, how can we invite them via technology into every classroom to be able to increase the ratio of teachers to students? Mm-hmm. In many ways, controversial. I'm sure the teachers' union would hate the idea. But at the same time, if we can hire people that for a great living wage in another country that fundamentally changes the way in which a classroom operates, those are the kind of things we should be thinking about. Mm-hmm. And globalization enables that. And it's time for us to take it beyond sort of, you know, technology, take it beyond, you know, the automobile industry and look at how the nonprofit sector can really leverage that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. 5 minutes. We're going to take your questions in just about 5 minutes. And so please start lining up at the at the mic in the aisle. Okay, if you have questions. Well, what would you give if you were talking to a person who was just getting out of school and wanted to do something important, wanted to start their own nonprofit, or wanted to be a part of a movement? What would be some of the things that you might? One thing you said was, you know, start in the corporate sector first, but other things that you might talk to someone in that. What other ideas might you have for them to move ahead in wanting to be a part of either the nonprofit sector or just doing good work?
Yeah. I'm actually working on a book on that topic. Uh-huh. So I get so many requests on that topic. And actually, I think the biggest thing you can do in many ways is go into the for-profit sector, at least at the start of your career, and look at how you can take your power sitting in a corporate seat to do good. And I think it's everything from if you're the assistant to someone and you're ordering lunch, how do you order food that's going to be sustainable, et cetera, and leveraging that opportunity to, if you're in this, you know, get a job in supply chain where you can actually make a difference in terms of what's ordered, who the suppliers are they environmentally friendly? I mean, you can make a small decision that's just like a back of, you know, a random little decision in a company that's huge that has a bigger impact than 30 nonprofits put together just because you affects such a huge supply chain. So I think if you really want to make a difference, working in a company is one of the best places to do it, and you'll get the skills sort of that later on can enable you to move into the nonprofit sector, move into politics, or what other area you'd want to go into. Mm-hmm. I think otherwise it's really working in one of these many sort of social entrepreneurial organizations that are very fast growth and are really dedicated to developing the next generation of leaders. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the Fortune 500 nonprofits, the Red Crosses, et cetera, don't provide as much of that. So in many ways, I don't think they're the best place for someone to start coming out of college or graduate school.
Mm-hmm. What about the sustainable or green MBA programs? Do you know much about those?
I've read some. I think it's very nascent. Uh-huh. To me, it's one of those things. I mean, I go back to the whole .com piece again, where there's sort of it was thought of as this whole new industry, and then it just became, in essence, like another channel for the overall, you know, business community. And I think a lot of this is a similar piece, which is there should be no such thing as a green MBA. MBA programs just fundamentally need to change. And I think the first stage in that is separating it, but I would be really disappointed if 20 years from now that still existed. Because those principles should be more fundamentally baked in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any last thoughts that you have? We're coming down to almost at the end of our time. Just what thoughts might you like to leave with the audience in terms of what they can do, how they can be involved, et cetera?
No, I think the number one thing for me is just, my grandmother and I talk about this a lot because she's been around the block in many different countries. And I think it's just really important to stay optimistic. I think that there is so much reason to feel optimistic about every single issue mm-hmm. in this country and the world. There's clearly the resources, there's the people, there's the intention. We just all have to play that role of being an evangelist for optimism and connecting people. Because I think real activity happens when you connect two people to three people to four people. And if we each do that, I think fundamentally there's reason to be optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, time is up for our discussion between the two of us. For the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's In Forum program, and tonight we're talking with Taproot founder Aaron Hurst. I'm Kathleen Fletcher, director of the Institute for Nonprofit Organization Management at the University of San Francisco, and now let's go to the audience for questions.
Hi. This high-tech stuff is really tough on me. Hi. You've talked a lot about how the best way to help nonprofits is to get your experience in a for-profit situation and then bring it back to the nonprofits. Do you have any insights on people in the nonprofit industry who can also help to move into for-profit and what experience they can bring to the for-profit?
Oh, so the question is around sort of what experience, or what can for-profit professionals learn, in a sense, from the nonprofit sector? And it's an infinite list. I mean, as I talked about earlier, nonprofits are infinitely more challenging to manage because they've got so many different stakeholders, and decision-making with all those stakeholders is so much more challenging. So there's an awful lot around management, decision-making, stakeholder engagement, being able to live a brand and a mission. I mean, there's so much that I think can be taught. I think the challenge is that nonprofits are so under-resourced that when you take a job in a nonprofit, very often there isn't time built in for reflection, and there isn't the training of managers to be able to be effective in providing the training for people to pick up a lot of those skills. So inherently it's there, but with the resources and the lack of infrastructure, I think it's often hard for those things to be given to entry-level staff because they're just so busy putting out fires. And again, all of this, there's 1,000 exceptions, if not a million, so.
Hi. It seems to me that a lot of what you're talking about is based on attitude. And it seems to me that attitudes are developed when people are young. So, and you said you had a 2-year-old daughter.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you have any insights on what educators could do to really foster the kind of attitude that I think you're talking about getting nonprofits and the corporate sector to work together. And I think it does happen maybe in high schools, and I don't see it happening as much in post-secondary education in colleges. But do you have any thoughts on how, if you were going to design
sure.
a school, what would you do to make people come out with the kind of attitudes
yep.
that I think you're looking for?
Well, I went to a phenomenal high school in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was called Community High School, that basically said that you don't have to just learn in a classroom. And I think that's a big part of what it would take to build that kind of a school that would do what you're describing, is sort of recognizing that it's actual exposure. And one of the challenges I had with having sort of hippie nonprofit parents is I honestly can't remember a single one of my parents' friends that worked in corporate America. And to me, like fundamentally, they were this sort of scary people in a suit. And I had no understanding of like what they were actually about or what they did. So just fundamentally getting exposed in an earlier age to a wide range of professionals and seeing what those people actually do for a living. The more important piece to me, though, from a society perspective is less around that. And it's that it's more about the optimism. And I think a lot could be done by teachers and parents, et cetera, to really figure out how to talk about things in an optimistic way on a daily basis, to look for examples of things that are remarkable. I mean, for me, it's taking my daughter to an art museum. We probably go to the MoMA probably twice a month. And she's only, she's almost two, as she says. And she just loves looking at all. And to me, it's the beginning of just sort of showing her how amazing the world can be and how amazing the creations of people can be. And there's so many examples of that, from architecture to the environment, and just constantly being in awe and also just showing amazing accomplishments that other people have done. So the conversation is constantly about how you can do something and not about how you can't do something. And I hear a lot of parents that spend most of their energy putting boxes around their kids, and I think that that leads to a lot of this sense of lack of empowerment. And I think if we fundamentally show examples of how wonderful the world is, people are going to want to invest in it.
Other questions? Well, one thing we talked about before was, before you and I actually came out here, was the issue of nonprofits providing social services that perhaps some people feel that the government should be providing. And as the government retracts, if it does, can nonprofits take up that slack? And we were talking about the politics of various administrations, and on both sides of the aisle. What were some of your thoughts? I thought your thoughts were very interesting, so perhaps you could share them with the group.
No, I mean, I think now that I've worked more with the White House and doing this work in Washington, I'm all the more convinced that D.C. is not a great source of solutions, nor is it a good source of management. I mean, they're really... It's so entrenched in a certain way of doing things. I think we almost need a revolution in some ways, not in a fight the power sense, but more in a rebooting the system. Because we've become so entrenched in a certain way of doing things, and between unions, between government bureaucracy, et cetera, we're just not fundamentally, even with the best of intentions, it's so hard to make any motion forward. And I think to me, that's part of why I think governments stop being effective in providing social services. And it's so frustrating, because I want to say the government should do something about healthcare, they should do something about all these different issues. But right now, the system's not fundamentally built to address any of those issues, even with the best of intention. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was actually interesting. I went to a speech at the Aspen Institute this summer by Newt Gingrich, and I keep on talking about it, because I just, politics aside, I think he's got he's a brilliant man, and he's got a lot of insight into management. And I think fundamentally right now, people need to stop looking as much at politics and look more at management and look at how do we elect good managers and spend the next 20 years on management and fixing the systems that are in place rather than worrying about as much sort of the polarizing issues. And if you look at almost every single issue from Social Security, healthcare, education, military, a lot of the problems stem fundamentally from bureaucratic and management problems, and a lack of ability to identify working models and success and being able to amplify that, and instead sort of becoming more and more entrenched in an existing way of doing things. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's the biggest opportunity around that.
Mm-hmm. Well, another question that I will ask, although it's a change of subject. One of the things that happens in the nonprofit sector often, and I've heard this for many years, is someone will stand up and say, we shouldn't be called the nonprofit sector. Yep. We should be called the social sector. We should be called civil society. We should not be defined by what we're not instead of what we're for. And I'm not sure that there could be any change. I think the word nonprofit is so instilled in us now. But I'm curious as to whether, since you have gone back between the two sectors, as to whether you have any thoughts on that. Is it a good name for the nonprofit? Is it good to call our sector, the one I work in, the nonprofit sector?
It's clearly a terrible name. I think it's hard to argue that it's a good name. There's a question about what would it take to change it, and is it fundamentally worth that effort? And there's a number of nonprofits like Ashoka and some others that are very dogmatic, and like if you use the word nonprofit, they correct you and they use whatever their catchphrase is, whether it's civil organizations or whatever that happens to be their nomenclature. And their hope is that it would catch on, but it doesn't fundamentally catch in because it's, as you said, so ingrained in how we talk about our society. Terrible name. Don't see anything happen with it. Yeah. It'd be wonderful if we could do like a rebranding project and press a button and all of it just suddenly changes. But unfortunately, that's not really the way the world works.
Yeah. Well, what are the biggest things? You mentioned branding is one of the things that people come to you for help with. What are some of the other things that you would, if you were able to give even more services than you can through Taproot, what are some of the other things that you see, particularly in your own work with nonprofits, that they need?
Now, the two areas which we are going into in the next year that I think are absolutely critical, one I've talked about, which is human resources. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of nonprofits have never been exposed to good human resources. So there's a lack of knowledge about even what they want. But when they get exposed to it, I mean, it's like my daughter when she first had chocolate ice cream. It's like, woo, glad I found this. And I think that HR is a very similar thing. And I'm not talking about the paper pushing HR. I'm talking about strategically thinking about your people as assets and your organizational development. And that, to me, is tremendous potential. And the other goes back to my comment around Jim Collins and the whole mm-hmm. idea of discipline. And what we've really seen is that nonprofits do a great job of getting their board and management team and stakeholders aligned during their strategic planning process. And in fact, nonprofit mm-hmm. strategic planning is mostly a facilitation exercise. Whereas in business, it's not really a facilitation exercise. It's an exercise of analysis and decision making. And I think the challenge of the nonprofit sector is there hasn't been the resources to do the effective research and analysis to feed into mm-hmm. that facilitation process. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you're facilitating a somewhat hollow conversation with a group of people that are already bought in and have had similar experience. Yeah. So you see very little change and very little ambition in that system. So one of the things that we're really looking at is how can we get business professionals, not to do strategy, because I think, frankly, it's not a great fit for a lot of business professionals, but a lot of them are market researchers. They are people who know how to go out and gather data. So going out and doing benchmarking, going out and looking at what else is going on in the environment, being able to do an honest assessment of the capacity of an organization, all the things that should feed in to that facilitated process that the nonprofit sector has become so good at. Mm-hmm. And the second piece after it is that in the nonprofit sector and in the for-profit sector, there is a tendency to write a strategic plan and then put it on a shelf. And then you revisit it 3 years later. So trying to look at how do you operationalize that work. Mm-hmm. So after this facilitation has occurred, creating a scorecard or some measurement system so that the management team, the board, et cetera, on a quarterly or monthly basis can look in at how they're doing against that strategic plan, which really makes the strategic plan have legs and a life, mm-hmm. Which I think is absolutely critical. And those are two areas where I think business professionals could add value in the strategic planning process mm-hmm. While really honoring that amazing thing that goes on in the middle, which is that facilitation process.
I couldn't agree more.
Good.
From many years of experience. We have another question.
Yes, I would like to know the meaning of Taproot. What does it signify, and why did you choose that name for your organization?
It's not obvious. the first pro bono project we did was for ourselves, and our board chair of 5 years was working at Landor Associates, which is a big branding firm. And they generously put together a team and did this whole branding exercise for me. And it was a good exercise in letting go of control. Because early on, like, there are some names coming out of the system that I was frightened by, to say the least. But in the end, they suggested the Taproot Foundation. And a taproot is a carrot or a turnip. It's the core root in a plant where all the tributary roots go into to enable the nutrients to go up and let the plant flourish. And I love the metaphor of the idea of us being a taproot where all these great nutrients in the community could come together to enable the overall community to flourish. And it's also just, it was something that hadn't really been widely used with the exception of a heavy metal band in Seattle. So we felt like it was something that we could really own and that we could really build a brand around. And the foundation piece, I think, may have been the smartest thing I did with Taproot because it's so much easier to get foundation meetings for funding when you have foundation in your name. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you the number of times I sort of send out an email to a foundation, they assume they're talking to a peer, and we walk out with a proposal request from them. So I don't know if we'd be here today if we didn't have foundation in our name.
Okay, thank you.
That's very good. Okay. Something just went out of my mind that I was going to ask you. Yes. Where would you see, if you, your crystal ball, where would you see Taproot in, say, 10 years, 20 years? We talked a little bit about the future and how you're growing, but what would you really like to see it look like in when you're middle-aged?
Sure. I feel like I'm getting pretty close now that I have a kid, but No, I mean, I think as a nonprofit, and this is one of the differences between a for-profit and nonprofit, I think about it less around where I want to see Taproot and what progress I want to see made towards our vision. Mm-hmm. So to me, we have a goal that by the year 2020, which is closer to the 10-year mark, that the business profession as a whole, which is a pretty diverse set of diverse population, would have adopted the pro bono ethic the same way the legal profession has. So if you look at the legal profession, I mean, almost every attorney understands their opportunity and responsibility to do pro bono service and the power of it. And it's instilled in them through law school, trade associations, et cetera. So I'd love to be able to do a survey of lawyers and business professionals in the year 2020 and not be able to fundamentally discern any difference in how they responded in terms of their understanding of that responsibility. Because if we did that, we'd have so much more labor available to the nonprofit sector. So to me, everything we're doing over the next, 13, 14 years is geared around trying to achieve that goal. Because fundamentally, if we let that level of resource become available, the infrastructure will be built to support it, and the nonprofit sector will be a completely different animal.
So what advice would you give to someone who is wanting to be like you, a social entrepreneur, and start an organization to carry out their vision?
I think it's all the cliches. It's a hell of a lot of fun and a hell of a lot of work. the first year and a half was on my credit cards for working out of my kitchen, and I think there's a romanticization of that, but there's also a lonely reality of doing that, and just sort of the drive that's necessary. And I think asking that question, are you ready to make that kind of investment, to build up the debt, to be able to really sort of pursue something and know that it's going to work even when most people were telling you that there's no way that the model would work, I think it's a hard thing to do. I don't want to say that in an arrogant way, but looking back on it, I don't know what I was thinking exactly. So I think part of it is just really going into it with that kind of a test. I think the other piece to me is some advice someone gave me once, which is really think about who you want to work with. And one of the things that I've loved about Taproot is I get to hire and fire people at will, which is a wonderful thing. Because there's so many organizations I've been a part of where there were so many people that I felt should be fired and weren't fired. And the whole organization was dragged down, felt like as a result of a lot of poor performance. And to be able to build an organization not only with high performers, that according to your definition, whatever that is, but also just the people that you want to work with every day. And I think when you think about the organization you want to create, make sure you're building an organization that's going to be naturally hire the kind of people that you want to be around. And I think if you find a model that you're passionate about, that naturally the people you'd hire for it are the people you'd want to have lunch with, you've actually got something that has a chance to succeed. And I've had a lot of ideas for things that I think would be models that would absolutely work, but I think about who I'd hire, who I'd be selling to, who I'd be serving, and I fundamentally wouldn't want to have lunch with them every day. And that to me was like a big determinant of saying that's not something that I want to do.
Yeah, yeah.
The lunch factor.
Okay, we have one more question.
I came late, so excuse me if you already covered this, but looking at the emergence of hybrid and not-for-profit corporation models, what do you think is the future of organizations or companies like Rubicon, Pura Vida, Benetech, all of those?
Sure. It's still such a tiny percentage of the overall nonprofit/corporate sector that I think there's still a lot to be seen in terms of where that goes. It makes sense at some level. I think there needs to be a difference in the corporate structure for it to really work and in the way the tax structure works around those types of organizations. So there's a lot of structural work that I think needs to be done for that kind of hybrid organization to really thrive. I think the only thing more complicated than running a nonprofit, which we've talked about, is running a hybrid. James Shepherd, who I mentioned earlier on my team, sort of talked about working in a for-profit organization that had sort of an education mission associated with it and how challenging it was to sort of go back and forth, because at the end of the day, you are a company, but if you have some kind of a social mission associated with that, it just is dizzying and it makes decision-making incredibly hard. So I'd say Godspeed and good luck to the people doing it, I guess, is the number one thing.
Okay, I think we are done, and thank you very much for your attention, and thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
And let's give a big hand to Aaron Hurst, founder of the Taproot Foundation, for his thoughts here tonight. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum is adjourned.